You're listening to Red Nation Online.
Welcome to From the Black Hole, episode 74. On today's podcast, we welcome back Percy Hoff of Astra Academy to talk all things development with Canadian soccer.
I'm sitting here with Percy Hoff. He's the director of Astra Academy here in Saskatoon. He's also had a ton of involvement with the Saskatchewan Soccer Association, and he's a friend of the podcast. He's already been on once before as a guest. I was doing some vocal recording work this weekend, so my voice is kind of shot, if anybody's wondering. But Percy, I'll pass it over to you. Maybe just do a very, very brief bio again, just so people remember the wonderful individual that you are.
Oh, thank you. been involved with soccer in the province since 1987, essentially. When I came from South Africa, I lived out in Warman initially and got the Valley Soccer Association started out there. And I've been involved with Saskatchewan soccer, as you said. I've coached provincial teams, I think, every year since 1991. Without a break, so that's been a really good experience for me. Coached at the University of Saskatchewan for a while, and of course started the academy, the Astra Soccer Academy, and always looking at trying to change things in the game for the better. And
which has always proven to be a struggle in this province, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's like we keep spinning our wheels. We're still talking about the same things that we did 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the main topic we're going to touch on today, and it was actually Percy's idea as well. I unfortunately can't take credit for this one, despite what all of my glorious fans of the podcast probably believe would be my brainchild, but this is Percy's, so he gets the credit for this one. But we're going to take a look at the topic of clubs, and mainly clubs that have a winning versus developmental philosophy, and sort of what is happening in Canadian soccer between those two ideologies and how it's sort of shaped, I guess, where we've been and perhaps where we're moving.
Yeah, I think one of the problems is that our developmental system, if we have one, seems to be based on competition rather than on learning.
Yeah.
In countries where development comes first, you typically find that people are, you know, winning is a good thing, but it's not the most important thing. So they don't sacrifice the development of a player in order to win games. So to put it in perspective, you know, you could do the wrong things in terms of how you play the game if you selected big, fast 10-year-olds that outran everybody. Mm-hmm. And that would get you results. And that's what we tend to focus on in general. I think it's changing. And I know that Jason DeVos talks a lot about that same sort of thing. And it's just that I think that the two are diametrically opposed when you're thinking about winning rather than developing the player. It gets in the way. So I see lots of times where players are, for lack of a better term, sacrificed in order to be able to win games and championships and city championships or whatever the case might be.
Yeah, and I don't think we even get to see the magnitude of it here as much as they would, let's say, in Ontario or BC. I mean, I know from a family connection perspective with my cousin's two daughters, it's cutthroat in a sense of whether they're going to make it on the provincial gold or what are they? I can't remember. Provincial premier, and then there's gold, silver, bronze. I mean, they're categorizing kids already at a young age. I mean, His youngest daughter, Brianne, I think she is up in Premier, and her older sister, I think, is gold. But there's even a cliquey attitude that seems to go with it. What's that like here in this province?
Yeah, I think it's much of the same. I mean, what you typically find, and I don't think there's been a study done here, but I would bet that it's about the same, is what's referred to as the age bias, where you find that, you know, upwards of 40% of the players that are selected to the premier teams or to academies or whatever the case might be will be born in the first two quarters of the year. Mm-hmm. Then you'll get roughly 20-something percent that will be born in the third quarter and only 10% that are born in the fourth quarter. Mm-hmm. So the question then becomes, is it really the talent that's surviving, or is it just the bigger, faster kids that are surviving? And there's a famous famous book, too, called Outliers, that many people have read that talks about NHL players, and the same age bias exists in hockey as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's interesting data to bring up. What other data have you seen that relates to this kind of overall theme of winning versus development?
Well, there's an interesting study that was done in Holland at the Feyenoord Academy by a guy called Raymond Verheyen.
And he's Dutch. He's got to know his stuff, yeah, right?
That's right. Exactly. And what they found was exactly that, you know, 46% of the players in the academies were selected from players born in the first two quarters of the year. And then they switched the age groups. They moved from the August 31st cutoff date, or August 1st cutoff date, to January cutoff date. And they found that all of a sudden, after a couple of years, all the players now being selected were born in the first January, February, March scenario, right? Mm. So now instead of the August, September, October babies being the players most selected, the January, February, March ones were being most selected. So the bias actually shifted when they changed the cutoff date. So I think that's proof enough that this is what happens. And so, you know, I think that what they found now, I was at the IX Academy in November of last year, and they were talking about actually now putting players in training groups by quarters of the year. So there were four training groups for every year that they had, and they're finding now that they actually get the true talent starting to come through because they're given a chance to develop. And you see, it's this critical period when a player is going through puberty. That's the problem. Because they're going through their growth spurt. There's all kinds of things that happen, as we know, when they're going through that spurt. So people that really know what goes on actually reduce the amount of training and allow the players to catch up to themselves, for lack of a better term. And they give them the chance to develop and to be able to express themselves and be able to not feel that they're lacking because they're smaller. And so on. So they give them a chance to develop in that period.
So along with age-related data, is there anything that's really been done when it comes to sort of like, I guess it's sort of related to the age aspect, but when it comes to actual physical development, physical literacy, what have you seen and what have you found from a lot of the different courses and a lot of the clubs that you've been that you've visited and participated in their programs? What do they have when it comes to that?
Yeah, well, I think that when we look at the youngest players, there seems to be a misconception that people will often say the best coaches need to be with the younger players, and that is true, but depending on how you define the best coaches. So young players need coaches that don't need a tremendous amount of soccer knowledge, but they certainly need people who are able to give them a great experience and get them to fall in love with the game, make it exciting, make it interesting, mm-hmm. and make it mysterious for them in a way. So that, you know, they're mystified by the ball, by how things get done. They love to see people doing tricks and that can do fantastic things with the ball. And these are the kinds of people that you need around those youngest players. You don't need somebody that's got a UEFA pro license to work with the youngest kids. I think that's one of the problems that we have, is that people shy away from wanting to work with the kids because they feel that they don't have enough knowledge, whereas all they need is a fundamental bit of soccer knowledge.
Just to let the kids play.
Yeah. What they do need is knowledge about how kids act, think, and behave.
Right.
And be able to give them a good time. Right. Physical literacy is a huge issue because, I mean, it's you know, soccer has specific movements, just like if you can't skate, I don't think you can play hockey.
Right.
And so in soccer, there's all different kinds of movements that need to happen. And for a lot of our kids, those movements are not natural. You don't see them in hockey. You might see a little bit of them kind of in basketball. But if you think about soccer, the movements are quite complex, aren't they? I mean, you're moving backwards, forward, long strides, short strides, jumping,
right,
hopping, skipping, shuffling around. There's right, all different kinds of movements. And so when they're younger, we really need to see that brought out rather than what they can do with the ball.
Right.
So get them started on the physical literacy, then introduce the ball and
right,
move them along in that fashion.
I know I'm biased because of loving the game, but I know from my own personal experience, just growing up as a kid playing,
yeah,
it always seemed that us soccer players were more physically capable than a lot of the kids that played other sports. And I don't know if it's just to do with the way that the game seems to be a little bit more dynamic in its movement, but I could always sprint on a,
yeah,
like a drop of the hat and stuff like that. Whereas a lot of the other kids who were just playing hockey, I mean, they were okay, you know, at that,
right,
but they were much longer. You know, I agree with it in the sense that there's definitely...
Yeah, I think it's also unpredictable, right?
Right.
Because everything changes all the time.
Yeah.
And so there's this
element, which is why it's awesome,
of what they call game intelligence, but really you got to make decisions based on what you hear, what you see, you know, visual cues, verbal cues, nonverbal cues, and then you have to make decisions based on that. And then once you've made the decision, you've got to execute it. So it's really a complex a list of things that you have to go through to be a good soccer player.
So why does it seem that Canadian professional players seem to struggle with that aspect? At least that seems to be kind of a common perception. And quite frankly, when you watch the game between, I'm sure you must have, between Canada and Mexico,
mm-hmm,
especially the one at BC Place.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a storm of everything going in Mexico's direction. Us missing chances, quite frankly, not reading the game as well as they did. They
right,
had the fast surface to play on the artificial turf.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of sort of fundamental basics that were going well for them. But then overall, just the overall reading of the game and that decision-making, it seems that our Canadian professional players don't seem to have that like a lot of other countries, especially a lot of our competition within CONCACAF.
Right.
Mostly the Latin American countries, right? Which
yeah,
basically
yeah,
is not us or the States.
That's right.
But what's with that? Why?
Yeah.
Why?
I think there might be an element of... Stephen Hart used to always say that one of the most overrated things is coaching. And I think that some of it might stem from the fact that it's all too organized and, you know, too many coaches involved telling kids what to do and what not to do.
Right.
I mean, I go up to the Hank Rice Center here and I watch under-10s playing. First of all, they play 7-a-side, which is too many players.
Which is ridiculous.
For them.
Yeah. Oh.
They play with the boards dead. So I was taking stats one night and every 10 to 12 seconds, the ball hit the boards and it was dead. So they had to restart the game. And then there's two coaches on the field that take about 45 seconds out of the game, moving players around before they can restart. And I'm looking at the players' faces, and it's like, you know, they let us play, please.
Right.
Stay out of the way.
Yeah.
And so I think maybe too organized is one of the things that's in the way. I think generally the kids don't do enough just free play on their own, whether
okay,
it's soccer or any other kind of game.
Right. So when you say too organized, what does that really break down into? Like, what's the absolute basic fundamental on that?
Let's take a look at the community soccer situation in Saskatoon, where the kids all play in a community association league that's run by the Saskatoon Youth Soccer Association. So every, on average, the teams have, depending on the age, but 9 to 12 players. So every 9 to 12 players has got a coach. And most of the time, the coach and that little group of players is kind of like a silo. They stick together. They don't integrate with anybody else. The coach has sort of complete control over that group. And it might be a parent coach that has limited amount of knowledge. It might be a coach that has a bit more. But really speaking, it's all based on I think that team development should be foregone for player development until probably 15, 16 years of age, where the team comes first. But I've had every year I talk to kids that come into the Hollandia Club, and I'll say to them, what do you think the most important thing is if you want to be a good soccer player? And they'll say stuff like teamwork, passing, and those kinds of things. None of them will ever say being good with the ball, being able to control the ball, being able to do good things with the ball. And so this teamwork, and I get comments from the parents all the time, is that, well, you know, it was a good season, but I think that you guys focus too much on the individual player. We need to work on teamwork. So that whole concept of promoting the individual up to a certain age, I don't think exists with us. We're too worried about the team and what the team is going to do.
That's a really interesting fact about Canadian sports in general to bring up. And where do you think that's born from?
You know, I'm not really sure. It might be because we still, I think, see youth teams, and especially the very young ones, as adult teams. So we're worried about what they achieve, what their goals are for the season, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas kids just want to go out and have a bunch of fun. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so much I learned from my kids that, you know, the game's over and about 10 minutes later, they've forgotten that they lost. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember that one of my boys played hockey, and the goalkeeper it was under 8 or something at the time. And every week they had a different goalkeeper and a goaltender, as they say in hockey. And, so it was his turn, and I think he let in like 17 goals. And we were driving home, and he said to me, "Did you see the two saves I made?" So, I mean, I think that sort of underlies their perspective on the game, right?
Right.
Versus the adult perspective, where we're so concerned about whether they win or lose.
So that raises a fairly big question, which is, I think, a big elephant in the room when it comes to not only Canadian soccer in general, but just Canadian sport in general, is how do we shift away from this adult-centric or adult-projected focus, and how do we actually start to shift over to you know, just looking at what the kids actually need, right? Yeah. Having that free play, having the focus on the player rather than the team, where do we even start?
Well, I think it's education, parental education. You know, if we can get the parents understanding it and being able to back away a little bit and just let them have fun. I think that also if we could get the game into the schools where, you know, it becomes a common thing for them just to play on their own at school, I think that would have a lot, that would help a lot as well.
So, and I've heard a lot of people say parental education is a big piece, but how do you even approach that? Like, well, have you sat down with people that just
Actually, okay. I just did on Saturday. We had some coaches in, and we talked to them about that. And you know what? They do get it when you explain it the right way to them. They start to understand it. But what I've been saying to them is, why does everybody need to have a little team? I guess it would be okay to take them to games, but really, if we want to be more efficient, we only have a certain number of people that know enough about the game and know enough about sharing that information with the kids, that they're few and far between. We don't have a lot of people. We're not a country that, you know, has got soccer people coming out everywhere. So we need to be more efficient in the way we use those people. And I think that what should happen is we should look at coaching groups of players in communities rather than little teams. You know, so if we had two coaches working with 40 players and a couple of parent assistants, that would go a much longer way to getting the information across than it is when you have, you know, a coach for every 8 or 10 players.
So is it... is it out of line to think that we need to not only reassess the way that we basically teach kids the game, but just the fundamental structures in which we do that?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I think that one of the issues is that when we deliver, for example, the coaching courses, it's all technically based, really. A lot of it is technically based, but nobody's really looking at how it's structured. So the structure starts to get in the way of very good. I think the Canadian Soccer Association has done a good job with its, you know, fundamental and active start courses, the ones for the little ones. But I don't think that anybody really looks at, okay, we've given the coaches this information, but the structure that they're going to put this information to is actually working against us.
Interesting. I've had a lot of conversations with a number of different technical directors. Tommy Wilden Jr. from Calgary Foothills.
Right.
He's definitely a friend of the podcast.
Yes.
And none of us can have as good of hair as he does, unfortunately. That's something he's blessed with.
Yeah.
I talked with Bill Ault, who used to be one of the TDs of, I can't remember which club it is in Ontario.
Okay.
A few others who I know them by like Twitter handles rather than by real name most of the time. But anyway, there is definitely this common theme of you know, asking, you know, how are we actually teaching these kids and what are the structures they're being taught in? And it just seems like absolutely everything that we're doing is inefficient. Just everything. It seems like we need to completely dissolve everything, basically, and start at square one and build it and you know, build it and design it from there. That's probably not realistic. So how do we go from where we are here in your mind to actually getting to the utopia, to the sports development utopia?
Yeah, it's a difficult one because it seems to me that also people that don't have the knowledge about how to do this are the ones that seem to have the most influence in a lot of areas, right? So, you know, they might be running associations, they might be running clubs, and a lot of decisions are made based on what's good for the administrators, what works best for the club, and very little is made based on what the players really need. So very few people sit back and really look. And if you look, even in our coaching manuals, they talk about the characteristics of certain age groups, generally speaking. But very few people, I teach those courses every year, and there's very few people, once they've gone through the course, that you'd go back to them and say, what are you doing different for your under-10s or your 8 to 10-year-olds? And very few of them will refer back to that information. They've just gone straight back to whether they're winning or losing games. You know, so if you meet somebody and say, how's the season going? They'll start by giving you a record, probably, you know, with 6-0-2.
Right.
Rather than, you know what, we've come a long way. I had two kids that could hardly kick a ball, and now they've really come a long way. So I think that's what needs to change is just the culture around it, the way we look at it. And then the bigger culture, I think, is one of our enemies, because I don't think I've been asking this question of a lot of people lately, and nobody's been able to really give me an answer. So I have some videos from the German Association coaching 6 to 8 year olds. And I look at these kids, they come in, they're having fun, but they're also dead serious about the game. They come on time, they're there on time, the parents get them there on time, they focus, they listen. And then I look at what happens here, and especially with our younger ones, parents show up 15 minutes late, 20 minutes late. You know, the kids are leaving halfway through a practice session. Just the culture around how we look at these things seems to be so different. And I haven't found anybody yet that can tell me why it is. Maybe it's just because soccer is not regarded as a major sport in Canada. I'm not sure.
I was going to say, could that perhaps be a manifestation of, the overall kind of cultural perception of the sport. And in a sense, I don't think you'd find that with hockey.
No.
No, I don't think you would find that with football.
Yeah, yeah. I give you a good example. I was, one of my sons played hockey, and I remember bringing him to a game once, and there was a kid that had his protector over his hockey shorts. And the coach just about ripped his head off and said, you don't go out looking like that. Yet you can see kids every day playing with their shin pads in soccer on top of their socks or, you know, or the weirdest looking stuff on, right? I've seen kids show up to a soccer game with baseball cleats.
Well, I've seen swimming trunks instead of soccer shorts. Exactly. You name it. You name it.
Tank tops and volleyball shorts.
Yeah.
And so even the way we dress for the game is not. So, it's got to be, there's got to be a factor of the cultural approach to it as well.
Is the, and I'll make it sound dramatic, is the rise of academy programs in Canadian soccer a potential solution to that, I suppose?
I think it may be. I think it's how it's approached, though, because, again, there's standards that are being set. If we're going to end up doing the same thing with academies where we're just looking at winning, then that could be, we could end up just in the same place again. But if we've actually got academies that give players a chance to develop, and maybe they're not in the top group in the academy at this point, but we're not releasing them, we're keeping them around and giving them a chance to grow and develop, then I think that we might be able to solve some of the problems along those lines. The other thing in our situation here in Saskatoon is that, the clubs are volunteer run. So there's no sort of business aspect around it. And I don't know how many clubs actually have standards, have procedures and policies that are written down. I don't want to second guess people, but I would venture to guess that there's not a lot of that. And I think that at some point, maybe governing bodies, even like Saskatoon Youth Soccer, should start to instill some sort of standards that if you want to be a club in our system, you need to have these basic requirements.
So there's been a lot of talk in Saskatoon specifically lately, and provincially wide. Looking into the way that we have all these different artificial divisions, mm-hmm. and specifically in Saskatoon's case, we have all of these zones, right?
Yeah.
The zone system was set up. I remember talking with who's the technical director of SUSC?
Hugh Morris.
Hugh Morris. I remember talking with Hugh Morris over the phone. Hugh Morris actually phoned me.
Oh yeah.
One day, he got a hold of me because I was talking with the I think it was a registrar or somebody for their club at the time, and he got my number, and we got into this big conversation about why the zoning program came in and so forth. But anyway, we have the zoning system, and it doesn't really seem to be fixing anything.
No, I think that it served its point at one time, because what had happened is people were sort of forming super clubs and there was nobody to play against them. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, there was an incident where somebody had coached a provincial team and then got all the players from that provincial team to come to his. So they weren't clubs at the time.
Wasn't that you?
No, not guilty. Never done that.
Okay.
So, the thing is, what people don't understand, I think, for the most part, is that there were no clubs. It was like how the adult system is. Yeah, anybody could go form a team.
Right.
So there was this plethora of teams that people were forming and trying to attract players in different ways. So when they put the zoning in place, basically it was to stop that happening. So I think it served a good purpose at the time. And then we went through a period of really good growth, and the clubs or the zones as we have them now in around 94, 95, maybe even up to 2003, 2004, had like 500-600 kids in each zone. Now we're down to 250, mm-hmm. and the numbers aren't improving.
And they're dropping still, aren't they?
Yeah, they still tend to be dropping, holding steady for the most part, but dropping here and there again. And so I think that we've reached the point now that it's not just a zoning issue. There's other issues at hand. And the question is, why are kids not playing the game in the numbers that they did play it before? And I think that's the big issue.
Now, is it necessarily a problem that less kids are playing? Couldn't it be argued then that if there are less kids, more of the better trained coaches will then be able to touch on more of the actual registered kids?
That's interesting.
Couldn't it have an actual positive effect? There's actually Dino Rossi, who runs League One Ontario, is a decent friend of mine, and him and I were having a discussion over Twitter one day where he mentioned, you know, there seems to be a hyper focus in across the country in making sure that that registration numbers not only remain high but keep getting more, mm-hmm. keep growing.
Right.
And there's a hyper focus, and he made the argument that, you know, it might actually be of benefit to let those numbers retract if it means that more quality more quality coaching is reaching more of those registered players.
I think that's a very good point.
It's a concentration argument, basically.
Yeah, I think the issue then is that if that happens, which has already happened, mm-hmm. then five zones is too many.
Well, yes.
Yeah, right. So if we had two zones in Saskatoon with 1,100 players each, I think then you're really talking about getting that concentration right and being able to focus resources is what you're talking mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, have good coaches that can work within that club and have more of the coaches, instead of having the coaches scattered over 60 or five different clubs, have them just in two clubs. I think you're absolutely right. Probably we do. So, I mean, even if you look at the Iceland example, right, with Iceland being ranked so high in Europe with only 300,000 people in
right.
total, why is that the case?
Right.
And you're absolutely right. It's because they have very, very good coaching. Every school has, I was reading an article about it the other day, every school has a soccer program with, you know, at least a UEFA B coach running it. And so, yeah, I think that there is a lot of sense in that.
That's interesting. And so I guess in a sense, how does somebody finally get enough support behind some type of vision like that, or to at least be able to change people's minds? I know personally I've served with the SAS Soccer Board, served with Eastside Soccer Club. Sorry, Eastside Soccer Association. Mm-hmm. Both Don and James would kill me if they heard me say club.
That's right.
That was a huge deal.
Yeah.
And there's some politicking for you. How do we actually start enacting change? That's one of the biggest questions I always have for everybody I talk to now is, how do we actually enact change in the soccer culture and with people with the organizations that we have?
I think it's being prepared to give up some power for the betterment of the game.
But that'll never happen.
Yeah, then I think we're stuck. Then I think we're stuck forever. Because that's what's holding it back. I mean, everybody talks about wanting to get rid of zones and to move on. But then everybody, and we had this before with that. One time they were looking at, should the teams that go to nationals be just one team in each age group that's selected from around the city? And so to be able to do that, they would have to fly the flag of a certain club, because only clubs can go to nationals, right, mm-hmm. to club nationals.
Right,
and
which is a broken system in and of itself.
Yeah, right. And that all died in the water because everybody wanted it to be their club, and nobody was willing to say, oh, let's have so-and-so take it this year, and maybe we'll get it next year. Nobody would back down. Everybody wanted that. And I see the exact same thing happening with when they talk about open clubs or whatever the case might be, or two clubs in the city, nobody will back down and give up their little bit of territory that they control right now.
Interesting. So I was talking a lot with Dave Nutt actually before the new year, and it's something that I need to get back on his case about now that I actually have a little more free time. But he's been working on a project of trying to create a high performance league. Mm-hmm. That would probably be close to the level of, the Ontario Player Development League.
Right.
Or I can't remember what they call the one in BC. And then they have the Quebec, I think it's the Quebec Super League, basically.
Yes, right.
So it's basically your all the way from, I think it's U16, U18, I think is what OPDL might operate under.
Yeah.
Might even go further, might even go to U14.
Right.
But anyway, sort of with the idea of consolidation, so zone consolidation,
mm-hmm.
which really needs to happen, and the advent of a type of league like that, do you see some of these changes that you think need to happen being able to happen in that case, and how would it work?
I know that they're working very hard on making that league happen. But again, it's taking the players that have now decided that they're going to be in the high performance stream. Mm-hmm. It's going to be those players only. And then there's still this idea that there'd be the recreational stream, which would still have the PSL, as we know it, the Provincial Soccer League,
right,
and still go to club nationals. So where I struggle with it is that I just don't think, and we go back to our numbers issue, I don't think that there's enough players in our system to make that really happen as the way that people are envisaging that it should happen.
Interesting. So why, what's the central, I guess, yeah, what's the fundamental issue with it then?
Well, if you take, I mean, let's be very realistic. I used to run the regional development center for the CSA here,
right,
years ago, and you know, these are the days when Kaelin Kyle and Kerr McLeod and players like that came out and went to national teams, and we would have, you know, no more at the very top, we would have 16 players. In both Saskatoon, not 16 in each, but in total, 16 players in the province that we considered at that level that they could go to Edmonton to participate in the national training center programs. So, underneath that, you still had the leagues. Now we're taking the kids out of the leagues, which is, you know, I know the reasons for that, and I understand that. But I just don't think that it's enough to sustain both, because when you pull a certain number of kids out of the leagues that exist, then the leagues become uncompetitive, mm-hmm, and people don't enjoy playing in those anymore. Mm-hmm. So we've really got a battle, and that's why maybe the numbers thing is an issue. Maybe we need more players to sustain the leagues that are below these players that are being pulled out of the system to go to the, well, I shouldn't say being pulled out, that are choosing to go to the high-performance system.
What if the CSA made the proclamation that the youth leagues, as they are set up right now across the country, were to go away, and only these standard based type leagues, like an OPDL type league, were allowed to exist in the provinces? How does that change the dynamics?
I think what would happen is you'd probably end up with people that just wouldn't bother registering with the CSA. They'd just do their own thing.
So you'd end up with rogues?
Yeah, I think so. Or just small districts. I mean, even in Saskatchewan, now I know that there's small districts that feel that the standards are onerous. You know, the coaching standards, being able to have police checks, to able to have making ethical decision certification, respect in sport. Some of them are feeling that all these things, the standards that are being imposed right now, are too much for people that just want to kick a ball around in the summertime only. You know?
So, how could it work? Again, kind of going with that argument of maybe the player pool shrinking isn't necessarily a bad thing, because more of the trained coaches would be able to connect with more of the players, mm-hmm, or have a longer period to work with each individual player. Could the same argument or same logic not be put towards the fact that if a player is serious about it and wants to go towards that pro direction, they would then register with the CSA in those standards-based leagues? And if the players and the parents aren't serious about it, then they would just go play in one of those rogue leagues. Is that necessarily a bad situation, or why is that a bad situation?
I think it would affect. I think it would affect the income that eventually makes our whole system run. Right.
And what is
I
that? Think,
well, just the revenue generation from hundreds of thousands of kids registering.
Through player fees.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, those player fees play a critical part in sustaining our national teams and so on. So I think we need that. You know, I think that even though that makes a lot of sense about fewer players being concentrated to get the standard up, I can see that. But I think the problem that we really face is that, especially in Saskatchewan, I think we went to sleep when other sports were making changes. Right. So I look for example, when football started their flag football program, mm-hmm, tons and tons of kids were drawn to that. I was up at Hank Rice today, and the kids are coming in to play ball hockey.
Yeah.
Right. And hundreds of them.
Yeah.
And why? Because they're allowed to form their own teams. They're allowed to come in with their buddies as long as they got an adult coaching them. It's a much less structured environment, and they love it. They want to play it, and I think that that's what we need to get back is the enjoyment for the game. Get the numbers coming in at the bottom that start to filter up to the top, and I think just by that distillation process, you end up with better players at the end of the day.
So, kind of two thoughts. I want to first go back to the whole concept of what if there was only the standards-based leagues under the CSA and everything else could just do what it wanted.
Yeah.
And also eventually come back to the whole idea of soccer seeming to have this giant ego of thinking it knows best what to do in all sport. But back with the CSA, I guess could the argument then also be made that maybe the whole revenue structure of soccer in the country is fundamentally flawed?
I don't know. I've never thought about that. Maybe it is. I would have to, I'm not really into that side of the game. I'm on the technical side of the game.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be interesting to see how other, is the same model used in other countries. And I know that sponsorship is much bigger in other countries for
right.
the sport. I mean, I had a guy here from Holland years ago, and he was telling me that, just in his district in Holland, he got 2 million euros to spend just on youth soccer.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, huge differences.
Right? Don't worry. Canada compete with them. We can compete with
them. So I think that's why we need the registrations, right? Because we don't have that kind of sponsorship behind the game.
But I guess the idea I'm just trying to lead us to purposely is the idea that perhaps either the administrators of the sport don't do a good enough job of seeking out those alternate funds to registrations, or on the flip side, that Canadian society doesn't view soccer as a professional sport that deserves that type of investment.
Yeah, I would go along with the second
more
scenario.
Than the first.
More than the first.
Second
yeah.
scenario. Interesting.
I think that, where you've got ethnic societies, so Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver to a certain extent, you kind of get decent support for the teams. But once you get out of those areas, it seems to wane rather quickly, right? And if you look here, I mean, lots of kids registered, but how many people actually go and watch the game? And if you really want to see the culture around the game is, I was at the soccer center the other day, and there was provincials going on, and people are watching curling while their kids are playing a provincial soccer final.
Mm-hmm.
I find that pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So I guess sort of the fundamental argument underneath all of this, and I've also heard this from a lot of different people, is quite frankly the number one roadblock to the sport in this country is Canadian culture
mm-hmm.
in and of itself.
I would think so. Yeah. Yeah.
So can
you change culture?
Is there a hope? I guess my question I've been asking everybody as well is, do we even have a hope?
Right.
I'm not trying to break either of our spirits, but I keep running, I talk with yourself, with Tommy, talking with Dino, talking with Steve Sandor out of Edmonton, everybody. And Steve always comes back to me and says, well, you have to have optimism. What's the point of even caring if you don't have optimism?
Absolutely.
I always do. I think if you love the game enough, you can force that into yourself.
Well, let me say this, Jeff. When I came here in 1982, Canada beat the U.S. all the time in CONCACAF qualifying. It wasn't even close, right? We used to laugh at the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And then came the 94 World Cup. Then came the MLS, the professional leagues, and the legacy that was left behind from the World Cup. And it did change. They do have a different culture now. So I think there's always a chance.
What happened?
I think the money that allowed them to set up those leagues. And then there was somewhere for kids to aspire to go to. Because what do we have really here? A kid from Saskatchewan especially. Any Canadian. What's the chances of an MLS team? How many Canadians do we have starting on MLS teams?
Or NASL, for that matter.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Very, very few. So it's very, very difficult. And so what do they aspire to? They've got a much better chance of dreaming about a future in hockey or basketball or even baseball than they do in soccer. So I think it's very difficult. But like you said, I think that you have to always hope that something's going to change. But I don't see that we really market the game. If you look at Saskatchewan especially, what do we do to promote the game? You know, I sometimes get up early, I go to bed late, and I see softball advertising on television. Make it your sport. We never do that in soccer. It's like we think that people should be happy that we allow them to come play our sport.
So that actually takes me into that second topic, is why does there seem to be this, why does there seem to be such arrogance behind soccer in this country? There seems to be a lot of arrogance, and I don't know what it was born from. Personally, I blame the British for everything, because it's always the British who screwed everything up in Canadian soccer from the get-go. And it was. Nobody can argue with me on that. But why has it seemed that there is so much arrogance in Canadian soccer, in the sense of, well, we know how to do things the right way.
That's right.
You know, and we don't have to try as hard, because people are just going to come to it. They're going to come to realize that they're going to love it as much as we do. Right?
Or is it just that this is the way we've always done things, and this is the way we'll continue to do things? Because it's worked, even though the evidence is that we're getting into more and more trouble, especially in Saskatchewan. It seems to be that we're just going to plod along the same route, doing the same thing over and over and over again until, I don't know, until the game's gone completely. You know, the other thing is that when you look in the U.S., even the youth clubs, most of them are run like businesses, and most of them are businesses, in fact, whereas here, everything, we're still in volunteer mode. And it's very, very amateurish the way we run things. So like I said, there's no standards. There's hardly any paid people in the game. Whereas in the U.S., you know, it's open markets. People can go after players whichever way. And I think that raises the bar and forces people, because either you're going to be in the business or you're going to be gone. So you're forced to have better programming. You're forced to have better offerings for your players if it's an open market.
Interesting. I guess the last thing I want to touch on before we wrap things up is, what is Percy Hoff's utopian vision of soccer? First, we'll say in Saskatoon and sort of Saskatchewan, kind of in the province, and then across the nation.
Yeah. Well, talking about Saskatchewan first, I think that it would be the situation where soccer has become a mainstream sport. Kids want to play it. It's fascinating to them. It's enjoyable for them. They want to be in it. Parents not just register them and go and watch curling, but they're involved in the game. They want to see it. They want to learn about it. They find it exciting. And the numbers are increasing because of that reason, not just quantity without quality. But the numbers are improving, the coaching is improving, everything's moving along in the right direction. And I'm still remain convinced that I think we need to build that base, we need to get that enthusiasm, and in a nutshell, basically start to change the culture.
Okay, so you know what, I lied. We're not going to wrap things up quite yet, because there are two other things I wanted to touch on. So you mentioned when we were talking about how things changed in the U.S., and you mentioned the 94 World Cup, and then that there was a bunch of money injected, but there's still a bridge for me that's missing. Mm-hmm. What, in your eyes, caused that cascade? Why did it happen for the States like it did?
You mean the improvement, the general improvement?
Yes, the general improvement. What happened?
Well, I think it was the ability to have a professional league.
But why did that league show up? Like, what happened?
Because of the money that was given to them by FIFA.
So FIFA's money injection.
Yeah. Because after hosting the World Cup, they were left with this legacy, which was earmarked to start their professional league. And that's the difference. Now, we have problems. I mean, we've had a professional league here a couple of times, I think. Yeah. And the issue is our geography. It's very, very difficult.
The U.S. is equally as large as Canada.
Yeah, but the population, I mean, especially if you're sort of in the New England or the Northeast, I think that you can, you know, you seldom, you look at us here, if we want to play somebody else, the closest is Regina, 2.5 hours. I think that in the States, you probably drive, you know, a quarter of that, and you're going to find another club that you could play or whatever. So even like you look at, I think Winnipeg has an advantage over us for the same reason, because everything's concentrated around Manitoba, I should say, has an advantage because everything's concentrated around Winnipeg.
Winnipeg, right.
We struggle here because we're spread out. It's so difficult. And then you think about the whole country. People have to, you know, make these massive, if you're operating a professional league, just think of the travel costs alone.
Right. I know a lot of people are pointing to not just the GTA as a whole, but specifically to Brampton, Scarborough.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know about Vaughan, but yeah, Mississauga, Brampton, Scarborough, and just sort of, I guess, your rest of Toronto in a way, and are really, really hoping that Brampton can keep pushing out these gems,
yeah,
like Tiba,
yeah.
Like Kadisha.
Right. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of who else big's come out of Brampton. There's been a number of players.
Well, you look
at
the size of those clubs. I mean, I think that Oakville has something like 5,000 kids, if not more.
Mm-hmm. Alone, so, yeah, Oakville. There
yeah,
we go.
One of the largest one of the largest clubs in the world, for all I know. You know, a lot of kids, and we just don't have that here. And I think that the athletes here tend to play other sports. And so that puts even more pressure on us to do the right things for them at the right ages. Because if we're getting all the late developing athletes in soccer, which is what's happening to us, we got to then make sure that we nurture them and give them time, and we don't throw them out, you know, throw them off the boat too early before they've had time to develop.
Hmm. So I think I'll make this definitely the last topic we'll touch on, because we're starting to run out of time. But so there's talk of a pan-Canadian top flight, so equal to MLS.
Okay.
And in my mind, it should have the arrogance to say that it's equal, because what the heck's the point of doing it,
right,
unless they do that. But a top flight pan-Canadian league starting up. In fact, a rep for Bob Young in Hamilton went to the Hamilton City Council and got the permit to allow them to run a professional soccer club out of Tim Hortons Field.
Yeah.
And that's the latest proof that's come out that this thing's going to happen. And there's been a lot of speculation that they're aiming for a start of either 2017 or 2018. So anyway, with a pro top flight league showing up, and with the CSA's vision of bidding for and hopefully winning the 2026 World Cup, and with what must be a decent windfall that came from the Women's World Cup financially, would that have the World Cup 94 effect on Canada, do you think?
Well, I would certainly hope so. You know, we've been down that road before, but of course at that time we never had weren't generating income from the women's program like we are now. I think that support for soccer as a whole from when we had the old Canadian Soccer League, I think, has grown enormously. So I would hope that if that did materialize, that it would at least give us something to aim for, because I think that that's a big detriment, is that nobody knows where they're really going. I mean, how many players are really going to play for the national team? There needs to be other outlets, right, that are available for our players. And I would hope that that would lead to an improvement in the standards all around, because as people try to aspire to get to the top, everybody will have to lift their standards.
Excellent. All right. Well, I think that pretty well wraps up everything that
stuff
I wanted to cover. Yeah. Once again, thanks a ton for coming on.
Not a problem. Thanks, Steph.
And that brings us to the end of episode 74. Thanks for listening. And of course, thanks to Percy for joining us on the podcast once again. We'll be back soon with another podcast. So until then, take care.